One of my very favorite parts of the rebrand for this show has been the flood of new voices that we've been able to bring into the ongoing conversation regarding the life, legacy, and disappearance of Amelia Earhart. Over the years, a lot of attention has been paid to AE's upbringing in Atchison, Kansas, and for good reason. Every year, thousands and thousands of visitors flock to the beautiful Earhart home, positioned on the Missouri River, that served as home base during Amelia's early years. If Atchison, Kansas helped form Amelia the Girl, then 76 Brook Street in West Medford, Massachusetts, helped form Amelia the Legend. And that is where tonight's guest enters the chase. For over 15 years now, Margie Arnold has been studying the life and legacy of Amelia Earhart, with a recent particular interest in the home A.E. was living in when her life and aviation history changed forever. Tonight, we shine the spotlight on a period of Amelia's life that will shape how you'll see her in more ways than one. We're all about to take part in a masterclass on the legacy of Amelia Earhart in one of the most passionate debuts this show has ever seen. Welcome back to Chasing Earhart. This is Margie Arnold. Margie Arnold, welcome to the show. Thank you for joining me tonight. I appreciate it.
Thank you so much for having me, Chris. It really is an honor. I'm a big fan of all the work that you do.
Oh, well, geez. Thank you so much. I'm honored to have you. I really love bringing people in as guests that would be considered new names for the show, most of all because it gives me a good excuse to ask the first question I ask everyone who sat in that chair before you. It's a two-parter. First, give me a little information on your education and your professional background to start.
So my education background is directly linked to my childhood.
Okay.
I loved all things sports. I loved physical activities, games. I loved being competitive. I was a tomboy and I was a product of the Boys and Girls Club and YMCA. And thanks to Title IX, which passed in 1972, I was a recipient of a Division I athletic scholarship.
Wow.
I went on to play Division I basketball and soccer. And because I loved working with youth and coaching and mentoring kids, I got a degree in recreation and an emphasis area in social work. And then I worked for a while at Inner City Boys and Girls Club, coached basketball, loved it.
Wow.
And then I went on to Florida State University, where I got a master's degree in recreation administration and an emphasis in college teaching. Knew I wanted to get into college teaching. I just felt it. So I taught 4 years at Illinois State University. Mm. And then I went on for my PhD at the University of Illinois at Urbana-Champaign. And I've been in higher ed for the last 35 years.
Mm. There's a lot of similarities there. Social work. Where have I heard that one before? Okay, let's get into it tonight. Can you remember the first time you heard the name Amelia Earhart?
My story is not nearly as fun as yours, Chris. Your story is fantastic. My story is a little bit less exciting, but nonetheless, I'm sure I learned about Amelia Earhart in elementary school. Mm-hmm. Most kids did. Mm-hmm. And I'm very surprised that I do not remember that name from elementary school, because there's so much overlap now that I know so much about her. She loves sports. She was a tomboy. She participated in those, quote, masculine activities, as Muriel described.
Yeah.
And I, too, had scrapbooks, and sprinkled throughout my scrapbooks were articles and pictures of phenomenal women who were breaking the glass ceiling.
Yeah.
So it does surprise me that I didn't hook into her early on like you, but thanks to the entertainment industry in 2009, that movie, Amelia, with Richard Gere and Hilary Swank, you know, that sold me.
Yeah.
I remember before the credits were even rolling at the end of the movie, I jumped on my motorcycle and zoomed up to the local airport and I signed up for flying lessons.
Mm, wow. You know, there's really not too many people in the case, and I said this on the show, that have the fire that you have. I think that's where the conversation tonight should live, because there are so many people that are into the back half of this thing, the disappearance of Amelia Earhart and Fred Noonan, but that's not where your expertise lies. You're on the legacy side of things. So let's talk about that. What takes you from an admirer a fan, to someone that wants to step in and take action to uphold her legacy, which we'll get into here in a bit.
Sure. The more I have learned about, like Jackie Cochran once said, the more you know her, the more you love her.
Mm-hmm.
The more you learn about her, the more admiration you have for her, the more inspired you feel by her. She's a phenomenal woman, as you know. Mm. And so I feel like the more I got to know her and really understood the message that she was trying to get out there, and I know Bram Kleppner talked about that,
mm-hmm.
the more, especially now more than ever, I think we really need to pay attention to her message in fighting for women's equality and women's rights.
Yeah.
So it wasn't a far leap the last 15 years that I've been reading about her and talking to anyone who will talk with me about Amelia Earhart. It's just kind of a natural thing for me to get excited about someone who I'm so passionate about. And then in today's world, I think we need more of that conversation. So I am definitely more interested in how she lived versus how she disappeared.
Mm, yeah, that's a woman after my own heart for sure. Well, you mentioned Bram. When Bram was on the show, he talked about what's going on in Medford, and that is something that you have spearheaded. Bram gave us an overview. Give me the details now. How do you get involved in the, you know, we'll say fixing of a plaque outside the home where Amelia lived from 25 to 28, right?
1924 to 1928,
okay.
Right.
Yeah.
Okay. So Chris, I'm going to share this story with you because I don't think Medford, Massachusetts makes it into too much of the narrative of Amelia Earhart's full life.
That's right.
And I think it's a little overlooked and I think it deserves some attention. So if I can just kind of, you know, roll it back just a little bit,
sure,
and explain how she ended up in Medford and then what happened during those 4 years when she was there, that might help the listeners a little bit.
Yeah.
So Amelia lived in Medford, Massachusetts, which is a suburb of Boston. It's about 5 or 6 miles north of the city.
Mm.
And that's when she catapulted into the stratosphere. I mean, that's when her life really took off. But prior to that, in early 1924, Amelia and her parents, Amy and Edward, lived in Southern California. And during the first half of that year of 1924, her parents got divorced. At that time, Amelia and her mother sold off everything in the house, including Amelia's plane, with the intentions of heading east to Medford, where Muriel lived. Now, Muriel was already there. She found three of them a house, 76 Brook Street in Medford. And Muriel was there. She was getting her credentials in teaching. At this point, she may have already started teaching. So they sold off everything, Amelia and her mother, with the intentions of driving cross country. Now, this is 1924. We're not talking paved roads. We're not talking GPS.
Yeah.
So Amelia goes out and she buys this bright yellow 22 Kissel Gold Bug automobile dubbed the Yellow Peril.
Mm.
And she and her mother drove cross country for 7 weeks, going up to Canada, down to Wyoming, and going around, taking their time, having a great adventure. 7 weeks cross country.
Mm.
They finally arrive in Medford and Muriel is there, obviously waiting for her. So to put it in context, this was exactly 100 years ago this year.
Wow.
It was a century ago when she drove up to 76 Brook Street, the house that she lived in. So with that, they arrive in Medford and within 5 days, Amelia ends up at Mass General Hospital, Boston Hospital. She has sinus surgery.
Mm-hmm.
We've talked about that. You've talked about that on the show before. So anytime, you know, like to throw out those little nuggets about things that happen there, because if and when they do find her and if there's skeletal remains, perhaps there's something there that translates back to the surgery that she had at Mass General Hospital.
Absolutely.
Yeah, right. So you want to throw those nuggets out there just to make sure that, you know, whatever could be helpful. So Amelia recovers in the fall of 1924. It's a painful recovery. It's a slow recovery. In February of 25, she goes off to re-enrolls in Columbia University, only to have to leave before, I think, the end of the spring semester due to financial hardships. So she goes back to Medford. She does various jobs, including one that she left because she didn't feel like she got the right amount of pay, which I enjoyed hearing. But then it really starts to come together. She lands a job at a woman-run settlement house called Denison House. Now, right. You've heard of that. And for the young listeners out there, I'd encourage them to look that up. Denison House is a settlement house in Boston's Chinatown. It was the second oldest settlement house in the United States, right after the Hull House with Jane Addams out of Chicago. But the fact that it was founded by three women, I think Amelia loved that whole concept. Sure. She applies, she gets it, right?
Yeah.
It's founded and run by these three women. Syrian and Chinese immigrants are there at the settlement house. And Chris, this is what I love. Amelia is teaching a variety of things to the children and to the adult programs, but she also teaches girls basketball.
That's awesome.
I love that.
Yeah.
I love the fact that she was teaching girls basketball.
Yeah.
Now, when you think about it, does the name James Naismith ring a bell?
I've heard the name a few times. Yeah.
Not related to Amelia in any way, but he was the gentleman who invented basketball. Mm. And he invented basketball at Springfield College like 1891, I think it is. So it's during Amelia Earhart's decade when she was born. So basketball was just coming out when she was born. And then she learned how to play basketball and she loved basketball. And matter of fact, James Naismith, the inventor of basketball, founded the basketball program at University of Kansas in Lawrence. Mm. So we've got that Kansas connection with basketball and Amelia loving it and then doing that at Settlement House, which I love that connection.
Yeah.
So Amelia's at Denison House and she loves it. She takes the girls in her Kistler and she drives them up to Medford. She has campfires with them and she mentors them, tells them they can be whatever they want to be. I love that. Mm-hmm. In addition to her doing the social work that she loves, on the weekends, she's also flying down in Quincy, Massachusetts, which is about 10 miles south of the city. So she's got her social work during the week. She's got her flying on the weekend. And what's interesting about that is good old Amelia is not just flying. She's hanging out there all weekend long, like a sponge, absorbing everything she can about flying. She joins the National Aeronautic Association, the chapter in Boston. And then in a year, within 1928, she becomes the vice president of the chapter.
Yeah.
Not one to sit around. Mm-mm. So
Jesus, certainly not.
This is all happening when she is living in Medford. And I think in 1928, it really kicks into gear when Hilton Raley calls her. And then, as we know, she's the first female to fly across the Atlantic. Even though she refers to herself as a sack of potatoes, she was a huge hometown hero. When she came back, they had a huge parade for her in Medford. Thousands of people showed up, the governor, the mayor. She had a big parade in Boston. And what's interesting, Chris, is I think this is a fascinating quote from her sister, Muriel. I just read this the other day when I was doing research over at the Medford Historical Society and Museum. Muriel said, well, Amelia was happiest during this time in Medford. Mm. And I think that's an interesting quote. When you think about it, she was doing what she loved. She was doing her social work. Mm-hmm. She was flying. She had family. And she was writing a lot of poetry at that time. Matter of fact, she wrote the poem Courage in that house on 76th Street.
Wow.
Medford was really good to her. And she was good to Medford. And I think that's where she got her... She was grounded there. And I think anytime your foundation is that strong, that's when really mm-hmm. good things happen.
Absolutely. You know, it's amazing. I think people should really lean into this because as you said at the top, it's not something that is talked about an awful lot, but a lot of the things you're talking about, this is foundational, right? So this is right before 28, right butted up against 28 when she walks into Putnam's office and has that first pivotal meeting with her future husband and business manager and all the things that Putnam would become for her. We talk about Atchison all the time, and certainly Atchison is hugely important to Earhart's youth and kind of what made her who she was. But Medford, in that short amount of time, gives us a lot of the pillars of what made Earhart Earhart in that short amount of time. What you're doing there with Medford and with this plaque, which we'll get into next, I think is very, very important. Can you talk a little bit about sort of righting that wrong? Because you saw something we've been chatting back and forth, you know, off email a little bit for a while now. And so I'm kind of privy to a little bit of it, but even I don't know sort of the ins and outs of what you've been dealing with. I'm sure it's not easy. Can you talk a little bit about that process for you?
I would love to. So we fast forward to August 2020. We're at the peak of the pandemic. And like most of us, Chris, we just want to get out of the house and go walk around and socially distance, of course. Yeah. So I am not from Medford, Mass. I'm about 30 minutes away, but I knew about the house and I knew that there was a plaque in front of the house. So I drove over to Medford again, this beautiful warm summer day back in 2020. And I drove over to 76 Brook Street and I looked at the plaque and I was absolutely dumbfounded. Chris.
Yes, I remember.
I didn't know what to make of it. And I was quite astonished at the colorful language that came out of my mouth. But it was an unrecognizable image. And the image wasn't even of Amelia. It wasn't even of a woman. It was of a man.
Yeah.
I couldn't believe the first thing that went through my head was that thousands of school children over the past 50, 60 years have walked past that plaque mm-hmm. and not seen Amelia Earhart. They saw somebody. I don't even know who the person is. Mm-hmm. No, I don't think anybody knows who the person is, but it was horrible. And I just couldn't believe that all these years, there was this picture of a male pilot. I don't know who the person was, but I took a step back, took a deep breath and said, you know what? The intentions of whoever did this, it was a nice intention by putting together a beautiful plaque. You saw it. The plaque is beautiful.
It's just gorgeous.
It's really nice. It's just, it's troublesome to me that, you know, had that been Charles Lindbergh's home, there would not be a female pilot on that plaque,
right.
I assure you.
Right.
So,
that's a good point.
As Amelia says, the most effective way to do it is to do it. So with that, I knew I had to do something. So I started gently emailing Medford Historical Society and Museum. And of course, it was during the pandemic, so everything was slow. The response was slow. But eventually, I got connected and I became a member. I mean, I think that's a good lesson for everybody. You know, I'm not from Medford. Mm-hmm. I don't want to go in there like a bull in a china shop. I really wanted to get to know the people and learn the history behind that plaque and didn't want to step on anyone's toes. But at the same time, I felt very passionate that we had to change that.
Yeah.
And then I was willing to do whatever it took to make that happen. Amelia deserves better recognition. She deserves that.
Absolutely.
I was connected to John Anderson, who's the president of the Medford Historical Society, and his lovely wife, Heather Champney, who is the director of special collections. And once I got in with them, things really started to move along. And we formed Team AE. We formed a committee. We joined forces with the people who own the Amelia Earhart House. And when I say the Amelia Earhart House, I hope that people realize it's not a museum. It's mm-hmm. not open to the public. It's actually a young family that lives there. I want to make that clear because they do have people who oftentimes go on their property or maybe look in the windows, and it's not. It's a private home, so we have to respect that.
Yeah.
So once we got the committee together, Chris, it's a great committee. It's board members. It's the folks who own the house that Amelia lived in. And once we got people on the right path and we all said, yes, this needs to be corrected, I sent a letter to Amy Kleppner. And within a week, I got a phone call from Caleb Kleppner.
Yeah.
You know, and you know, Bram, and they are, I refer to them as a click and clack of the Earhart family.
Yes.
They are fun and they're funny. I have thoroughly enjoyed my email exchange with them. So we got together with this committee and we realized, yes, we have to do something. I connected with the Earhart family and I asked permission if it would be okay. Like, this is the plaque. I showed them a picture of it and then gave them four or five options. Would they mind if any of these were to replace? The reason why I think it's important to always ask for permission, because you don't want to disrespect anybody or the work that was done before you.
Absolutely.
But again, sometimes the first time around, we don't always get it right, despite the good intentions. But I did feel it was very important to get them on board and make sure that I had their permission, which I did. And I'm thankful for that. I think it's important to note that Muriel was there when they dedicated that plaque 50 or 60 years ago.
Yeah.
So again, I didn't want to disrespect anything that Muriel enjoyed seeing, because Muriel later on lived across the street from that plaque and she saw that every day. Mm. So who am I as an out of towner to go in and say, we need to remove that? So we had the Earhart's full support. I was so grateful of that. So here we are now in 2024, the year is a big year. So this year on Amelia's birthday, July 24th, her 127th birthday and the 100th year anniversary of when she moved to Medford, we are now going to have, I guess we should probably say, the plaque rededication for Amelia Earhart.
Yeah.
And we are so excited, Chris, about this program. I mean, I know that you like anniversaries.
Yes, triple down anniversary there. That's really great.
Yeah, it's going to be very exciting. We've got a great program lined up on board. We've got the Lieutenant Governor of Massachusetts.
Awesome.
Female. We've got the mayor of Medford, female. We've got the chair of the Eastern New England 99s who's coming. She's a former military pilot. She's amazing. She will speak as well. And then I heard the governor of the New England 99s might join us as well. We'll have someone read the poem Courage, because that's where she wrote it, at the house. And then Bram Kleppner will wrap it all up, unless Caleb tackles him for talking too long. Do you remember that?
A strong possibility.
A strong possibility, because Bram mentioned that in your interview. And then we'll wrap it up with a terrific birthday cake and sing happy birthday and do the unveiling. And it's just going to be a fun event, bringing people together, bringing the neighborhood together, and just remembering this phenomenal woman on her birthday and of her 100th year anniversary of when she arrived in Medford that helped to launch her career.
You know, I think anybody who's listening to this can hear the passion in your voice. I want to ask you the same thing I asked Chris Hare when he got into the show with me just a few episodes ago, but I'm going to flip it and sort of give you like a little bit of an Uno reverse on it. What's it like to dive into the legacy side and uncover little nuances and treasures and stories along the way? I mean, I imagine that it's in the little things that we can sort of potentially discover, you know, further insight into her mindset, some of the things she was thinking. As you mentioned, she wrote Courage, her most famous work, in that spot. It's got to be a lot of fun for you to dig into the nuances and the little things, into the trenches, and discover things like that.
Chris, it's so much fun. I mean, to investigate and to learn things and then to share them with others, the things they didn't know, is so much fun.
Yeah.
The Denison House no longer exists, but it's literally right around the corner from where I am in Boston. And I went over there last summer and I took a couple pictures, and I can see exactly where Amelia was standing with all the children in front of her Kissel automobile. Yeah. Because even though the settlement house isn't there, the building across the street still is. And I could see it. And I was thinking, Amelia stood right here working with the Syrian and Chinese immigrants right here where I am. Mm-hmm. Few weeks ago, I need to give credit where credit is due, Purdue University. You and I both think the world of Purdue.
Yes.
They transcribed something and sent me an interview that Dean Dorothy Stanton had about Amelia. And to learn things, just little things, about her favorite drink was buttermilk. Mm. And she loved waffles and bacon and little things like that, Chris, that make it into our program this summer, because we are going to have ice cream with buttermilk on a waffle cone and bacon sprinkles.
Amazing. That is creativity. It's taking things like that and making something new from it. You know, when you're talking about this kind of stuff, we're butting right up against 28 and the transatlantic flight. We touched on it earlier. When people talk to me about Earhart in media, and they sort of, I don't want to say challenge me on things, but for lack of a better word, we'll say when they challenge the legacy and they say things like the things that she did was all just more of a publicity stunt. You know, you can look at everything that she was doing in the years prior to transatlantic success. She was doing all of it anyway. She was doing the things that she really believed in. She was teaching children. She was working with women. She was advocating for women empowerment before she became this iconic pilot that everybody knows now. So I really want to stick that in there, because I think it's important to lean into that, because a lot of people in the public eye still sort of believe that a lot of Earhart's success was just nothing more than a publicity stunt. She was in the right place at the right time. Well, I kind of beg to differ. And I think everything that you've laid out, especially in the 3 or 4 years up to 28, I think kind of directly refutes that.
Look, Amelia Earhart is interesting because she was interested.
Mm-hmm.
Think about, Chris, she was a nurse's aide. She was a poet. She was a pilot. She was a woman's advocate. She was a stepmom. She was a visiting faculty member at Purdue. She was a social worker. She was a celebrity. She listened to opera music when she flew from Hawaii to Oakland. She was a teetotaler. She was the only female statue in the United States Capitol wearing trousers. This is a phenomenal woman who had a variety of interests, but she channeled what she loved, which was flying. Mm-hmm. So this is not a woman who I think just haphazardly, luck of the draw, happened to be there at the right time. I think she put a lot of time, effort, and energy like she did at that Quincy airport. She was there every weekend,
yeah,
like a sponge, absorbing everything she could about that. Mm-hmm. So when people say, well, you know, a lot of it was publicity, I disagree. And I think, you know, I'm talking to the choir here, but I think that she was incredibly talented. And I think she took it very seriously. And she was, in fact, fearless mm-hmm. in what she did. Mm-hmm. What I really appreciate, though, is as good as she was a pilot, no matter where she went across this country, when she stopped to talk to people across the country, she made a point of doing a couple things. Number one, if there was a settlement home anywhere in that area where she was stopping to lecture, she wanted to go visit the settlement house. She's staying true to her core of what she believed in. The other thing you'll notice is when she's going around the countryside, she always made sure that she went to women's associations. She went to Zonta meetings. She made a point to connect with women and to tell them basically, as you know, not about me. Don't look at me, what I'm doing. But what I'm saying is if I can do this out there, then you women can do whatever you put your mind to. So dream a little bit. Mm. So I think that for people to shrug off, well, she was a mediocre pilot. I disagree. I think when she's passionate about something, she's going to excel in it. There's very little that she did mediocre.
Yeah. Wow. Let's talk about some bigger picture stuff here when it comes to the legacy. This is all speculation, I know, and I'm sure the listeners will know, but let's do it anyway. Do you think Earhart would be satisfied with the strides that have been made, some in her name and some outside of her name, when it comes to women in aviation and maybe even just a sense of general equality?
I think that's a really, really good question. In terms of, let's say, women in aviation, what, is less than 7% of the female pilots in the commercial airliner women?
It's very small.
Very small. And when you add women of color in that, it's probably less than 2%. So mm-hmm. I'm not sure she'd be impressed with that. I think in terms of her 99 Association, I think she would be pleased to know that from her original 99 chapter members, I think now it's in the thousands and thousands representing 44 different countries. It's an international association. She helped to create that. Mm-hmm. Chris, two of the women coming to this program are 99s. And the only reason why I found who they were is through Amelia's organization, mm-hmm. the 99s. So that's a connection there. But in terms of women in general, she advocated so strongly for women's rights. She fought for women's equality in education and in the workplace and marriage and economic equality. You know, she wanted equality for everyone. I think she would be somewhat pleased with things. I know in the past that she said, it wouldn't surprise me, you know, 100 years ago or so, it wouldn't surprise me if women are building bridges in the future, or if they're putting away the bad people, meaning law enforcement. I think she was looking ahead that women are going to be doing these things. And so women, regardless of your sex, get out there and dream your dream and try it. Mm. I think she would be very disappointed to know that women are only making 77 cents to the male dollar.
It's ridiculous.
I think she would be disappointed to see where we are right now. Let's not get too political, but in terms of women's rights and women's reproductive sure. rights, I think we're going backwards. I think she would be very upset with all of
sure.
that.
Agreed.
She would be pleased in terms of the progress women have made out here in the world. I think she would also be very disappointed that the numbers, including the ones that we mentioned for women in aviation, I think she might be a little disappointed in that. Mm.
Well, so room for work. I think, you know, look, Earhart was a grinder. Absolutely. So I think she was one of those people that, hey, we've done these great things, but we're still lacking in these areas. And it's interesting to see how, look, Earhart was really sort of like a glass half full kind of girl. But when it came to certain things, she was sort of like a glass half empty kind of girl. I've never seen it like that in a historical
historical standpoint. It's weird. When it mattered, she could be really positive and can look at the bright side of things, but she also could lean into like, look, we're not there yet. We need to do better. It's interesting to see somebody that can sort of walk that kind of a line 100 years ago, almost, you know, that's 88 years now this year that she and Noonan disappeared. So, you know, we're working on a century ago, almost. It's pretty remarkable to see how somebody could look forward a century later and be in the classroom and do the things she was doing and have that wherewithal to know that like, this is where we're going to be in 100 years. You might as well get on board. That's pretty remarkable.
Unbelievably so. The vision that she had, I think you said it best on one of your podcasts. You were saying that for all we know, she kind of invented STEM. Yeah. She just didn't call it STEM.
Call it that. Yeah, that's right. I mean, she was doing it. She was performing master classes inside Purdue 100 years before STEM would become an acronym, like I've said so many times. So yeah, absolutely. This is a woman whose vision would obviously far out exceed her life, but it certainly wouldn't out exceed her legacy, which I think is really incredible that, you know, her vision ended up becoming part of her legacy, which I think is kind of beautiful.
I think it's beautiful too. When you think about the things that she did back then, I mean, the prenup, the open marriage, I mean, that's pretty remarkable. That's just unbelievable. And you know, I have two favorite quotes from Amelia. The first one I've already mentioned, the most effective way to do it is to do it. She was 100 years ahead of Nike. Had she just put the word just in there,
just do it,
the Earhart yes. family will be swimming in royalties and they'd be donating it to all the women causes out there. Amelia was ahead of her time. The other quote that I love, Chris, and when I get challenged in life or I take on something that I'm just not sure I'm going to succeed at, and this quote actually is on the new plaque, and that is, in Amelia's very kind, gentle, feminine voice, never interrupt someone doing something you said couldn't be done. Mm-mm-mm. I love that. It's a gentle, just step aside, just be quiet and let this person try.
Yeah.
And that quote can be for anybody, any color, any age, any gender, regardless. She had quotes that just transcended all the isms out there. And I think that's the type of thing that keeps her so relevant today.
Yeah.
She's a modern gal.
Yeah, absolutely. She was absolutely. And it is a very famous quote, but there's so much to unpack in that quote alone. You know, the way you could walk that quote and the different areas you could take it, it's really remarkable. And for me, I think I know the answer to this question, but I'll ask you anyway. We talked about it a little bit tonight. What is Earhart's role? How does it continue to be present when it comes to inspiring modern day youth? We're not talking about just girls here. We're talking about just modern day youth to challenge themselves. Like you said earlier, go higher, faster, farther. This is someone who people still look back on and say, man, the letters that the Earhart Museum gets, I talk about this all the time, the Birthplace Museum, that's happening right now. People are doing it right now. This year, they're writing to this woman, asking her advice on things. It's amazing. I've never seen anything like that. That is remarkable. What do you think her role continues to be, or what should it be moving forward?
Well, first of all, you just gave me chills with that, Chris.
It's wild. It's wild to see that. I remember like looking at my wife, like thinking, God damn, like I can't believe this. This is amazing. This is legacy on a level that you can't buy.
You can't buy.
Yeah.
She continues today. Well, you know, and thanks to the strong women out in Atchison, Kansas, they do a phenomenal job. They finally were able to get the statue in Statuary Hall, the U.S. Capitol. Mm-hmm. You know, millions of people, millions of little boys and girls are going to see Amelia Earhart's statue. So that's just going to reignite it over and over and over. You know, I'd like to think back of 1928 when it became worldwide news that Amelia Earhart was the first female to be in a plane that flew across the Atlantic. I like to think that women sitting around that dinner table straightened up a little bit more that night. And I think it shifted the conversation that they had with their little boys and girls around the table. Mm. And I think it kicked in then, and I think it continues today. And when we see things like the movie Amelia or the wonderful educators that are out there, like the one you had that introduced you to Amelia Earhart in third grade,
Yeah. It's
all relative and it's meaningful. Again, I go back to Amelia Earhart is interesting because she's interested. She was so interested in so many different things. And I think that's what keeps her in the news, in the classroom. And let's face it, every couple of years when someone comes out and says, I think I may have found the plane, it reignites interest for so many people, although it might be difficult for some other people to hear these things that keep coming up every couple of years because there are descendants of Amelia Earhart's. But I do think that that every couple of years coming out certainly perpetuates and gets people all excited again. And then the younger generation learns about her. But
yeah,
going back to your original question, I think what Amelia Earhart was advocating in the 20s and 30s, we still need today. We still need to hear it. So what she was saying is still relevant today.
Oh, well, we're going to get into some of the theory here in just a little bit. I'm going to hold off on the plane, but I do want to ask you something that I've never asked anybody on this show. And I think you're a good person to answer it because you don't have an iron in the fire when it comes to theory, and that's really important. From the standpoint of narrative, okay, we're only talking about narrative. It feels like everyone wants to tell her story, especially the true ending. We'll put true in air quotes. I feel like we can change the narrative based on whatever given theory happens to be dominating media at any given moment. And we'll get to Tony Romeo, we'll get to Buca, and we'll talk about a little bit of that in a minute. The bigger question, and I think the more important one, is has the storytelling changed in 88 years since she's disappeared? Has Earhart become a victim of spin?
That is a great question.
Yeah.
I think she has become a victim of spin. Look, I have no skin in the game. I mean, I know enough about the theories to be able to have a conversation over a cup of coffee with them, but I don't know the details. I don't come from an aviation background or the scientific figuring out the latitudes and longitudes and time zones. I agree with your process in how you have gently embraced all of them, but have committed to no one theory that's right or wrong. And I think that's the best way to approach it because people have spent, as you know, millions of dollars trying to figure this out. And because they're so heavily invested financially and emotionally and everything else, they claim it, they own it, and that is the answer, and that's it. End of conversation. Mm-hmm. So they're very well guarded. We know from research that the best way to really get to the problem solved is to collaborate. And it's to pull the best parts of all of us together, rest aside your ego, and figure out where we go from here. In terms of spin, let's talk about that. I don't really know how to answer that, and I feel like I'm disappointing you.
No, take your time. It's not an easy question to answer. I think it's a controversial. I mean, I'll give you my answer. I'd say absolutely yes.
Yeah, I'm curious to hear yours, and then I'll bounce back to you.
Yes, she's become a victim of spin. It's like a double-edged sword when it comes to Amelia Earhart. I live on the legacy side, but I have sort of gotten into bed with the disappearance because of the nature of what we do. I have been on people's shows as a guest. Particular person's show happens to believe a given theory, and I will come on the show and I won't smash that theory, but I will also tell you why that theory doesn't make much sense or why there's some things that really kind of like hurt that theory. And so people don't like that. And, you know, myself and Jen have both been sort of, you know, I don't want to say victims, but we've been on the, you know, on the victim side of things when it comes to just like, you know, just getting hammered on things that, you know, it's really remarkable kind of how all this works out. So I would say when it comes to the disappearance, when it comes to the varying camps, and I mean, I've gone through the entirety of the Amelia Earhart newsletters. I've talked to every living AES member that's still alive now. And I've gone through so much content, and there was so much bitterness. And there is so much bitterness in this case. It doesn't feel like that kind of bitterness should be attached to a woman like the one we've been talking about tonight. It just feels weird. And so I feel like Earhart, to me, really has become a victim of spin because it's now starting to hurt public perception. Every time somebody finds her, finds the plane or something comes out, it's like, oh, here we go again. It's like, oh, I thought they found her last year or the year before. And it's becoming sort of a little bit of a joke. And that bothers me. And I think that that matters when it comes to the content people want to put out when it comes to talking about Earhart or, you know, the theory that people want to come out when it comes to talking about Earhart, you know, walking certain things back. So yeah, I think she's absolutely a victim of spin to a certain degree. I think Fred Noonan, who is largely forgotten, is also a victim of spin when you talk about the alcoholism and the idea that him and Earhart maybe didn't get along very well on the flight, especially toward the end, and you know, all of that stuff. And it's all just really speculation, rumor, and innuendo, and a bunch of bullshit in my eyes. That's my opinion of it. I think she's absolutely a victim of spin. I think it's baked into the legacy now a little bit, and it's starting to hurt things. And that's where I personally have a big problem.
I could not agree with you more. You know, Chris, there's comic strips. A friend just sent me a comic strip that was basically what you just said. Oh, here we go again. Oh, look, it's another a sighting of Amelia Earhart. And, you know, there's a skeleton in a plane. Mm-hmm. I mean, it's just, it's not funny. And it has turned into a bit of a joke. And what bothers me about that is we are now forgetting about her legacy and the messaging that she was sharing and how talented and amazing she was as a pilot, as a social worker, as a poet. And so you're right, their egos are getting in the way. This rush to find the Holy Grail, I think, is clouding our perception. And I agree with Bram Kleppner, who said, Amy has for a long time now said, millions of dollars have been spent on trying to find this plane, when in fact, we have all these other issues in the world where perhaps things, that money could have been better spent elsewhere. But, you know, to each their own. If people have that money and they're passionate about it and they want to do that, then that's fine. But I agree with you, the longer this goes on, the sillier it becomes on the disappearance side, mm-hmm. as far as I'm concerned. It convolutes and it pollutes her legacy, and we start missing what that message was. People ask me, do you want that plane to be found or not? You know, if it's found, it's found. If it's not, it's not. Personally, of course, I want it to be found, because then I think, A, there's closure, and a lot of us want closure. But B, I do think there's a story that's going to be told there. Mm-hmm. I think there's information where we find it. Chris, I thought about this. Once they find her, and let's say I am a proponent, I believe in the crash and ditch theory. I think mm-hmm. she's somewhere around Holland. That's just me.
Sure.
And I'm entitled to my opinion.
Sure, of course.
But but you wonder, let's say that Tony Romeo's crew find it, and it's actually proven mm-hmm. to be her and Noonan and the plane. Okay, so deep breath here. There's a lot that can be unpacked there. There's a lot that can be shared, that final chapter, which I think it would be very interesting.
It would.
But moving beyond that, what can we now learn from all the other theories that are terribly wrong?
Mm-hmm.
The intention was good. How do you have 200 interviews of people saying relatively the same thing, but yet it's not true?
Yeah.
It's not Amelia Earhart. So if I was just starting out in higher ed 30 years ago, I would be wanting to dive into how do theories get created and how do they go terribly wrong? And I would love to look back at your podcast and listen to all those interviews of people who are behind the different theories and do some sort of qualitative content analysis, and to help us understand how theories get stronger and stronger and compelling evidence, but yet, bam, mm-hmm. it's not true.
Mm-hmm.
Be really interesting, fascinating. I think that would contribute to the literature in terms of how did we go so wrong when yeah. there was so much compelling evidence, but yet that's not true. She wasn't on Nikumaruru, for example.
Well, I think that's an excellent point you make. And I think, you know, as an educator and as someone who that's right in your wheelhouse, it's interesting to, we weren't really going to go here, but I think we might as well now, the importance of asking why. You know, I say this all the time, we have nothing. In this case, we have nothing. Bill Snavely's got something out of Buca that's really interesting. Tony Romeo has got something that he thinks he really feels is compelling, and he feels like they really feel like they've got it. You know, we got some things, but we don't really have any hard evidence. We're 88 years on now, almost, just a few months away from the anniversary, and we have nothing much more than we did on July 3rd, 1937. You know, other than we still got the post-loss radio calls, we still got the Itasca call logs, we still got what she said to Leo Bellarts, and now we have potential wreck sites. And I think because of that, and because of Japanese capture, because of all of these theories that have different types of evidence to back it, which I think is has always been the most fascinating thing about the case, it's really comes down to what evidence convinces you, really. You know, if you're, like I said, that's why we did Vanish. If you're in a jury box and we're pitching all of this at you, what's going to make the most sense? Maybe it is the Itasca logs. It's listening to Earhart and listening to people like Detweiler and Vincent and all those great guys that just say we need to listen to what Earhart herself was actually saying in those final moments. You have that, but then you got 200 eyewitnesses over in the Marshall Islands and Saipan that blow throughout the locals and the military and the U.S. government all the way up to generals and five-star generals and all this stuff that are saying she was absolutely here. As an educator, when you're trying to guide young minds that are interested in the case that you see have the same passion you do, but maybe for the disappearance side, do you recommend to them? Do you push for them to go and look at everything? Do you want all of that on the table, or can that be bad? Can that be a bad thing for historical mystery? No, that's a very long question.
It's a great question. And I think, you know, you do your research, you do due diligence, and you look at it from a variety of angles, and you create what the science and data is telling you. And all those researchers out there, the ones who are leading those theories, not to take away from them, they have done it. And they've gotten very involved and mm-hmm. very personally invested. And sometimes that can cloud, you know, you call that ownership. And then yeah, it's sure. when people take kind of poke it a little bit, that theory, you take it personally as if someone's poking you physically. And I think that's the danger in that. You are coming up with a hypothesis that is meant to be challenged. It's mm-hmm. meant to be tested. That's why we have that. But I think the bottom line is, and Chris, I think you have said this too, until they find the plane and they can verify the serial numbers on the engine, until they can find appropriate DNA from whatever remains that may or may not be out there, until it's really scientifically determined without any error, I think we're just going to keep going around and around and around. Mm. And that to me is too bad, because I personally am much more interested in how she lived than how she died. I'm much more interested in her birthday than her birth death. I mean, I could go on and on. Mm. I'm a strong advocate of her legacy and the amazing things that she did then that are still relative today. And I don't want that to be pushed away because of all this spin that continues today. There's so much more good that has come out of this than that.
Mm, that's great. Wow. All right. I got two more questions for you, and then I'll let you go for the get out of your way here. One of my favorite questions, I guess, to speculate on is multiversal in nature. What might the back half of AE's career looked like had she returned from the world flight? What do you think she would have done? What's that relationship with Purdue look like post world flight? Let's have a little fun speculation. And instead of looking at it from a negative standpoint, what might she have done upon return from the flight?
Great question. And I love it. And coming from higher ed from the last 30, 35 years, it's a wonderful environment to be in. You are in an environment where people are challenging you. Students are challenging you. You're helping to mold young minds. Amelia was doing that as a counselor, as a teacher at Purdue. I think she was just getting her feet under herself when she was at Purdue. She had only done it for a year and a half mm-hmm. or so.
That's right.
I think that when she and Noonan returned, that she would have been increasingly more and more involved at Purdue University. I think her desire to open up a lab where women could come in and tinker with equipment and engines and learn oil change and just be free to be around things that typically were not really taught, and to do it in a safe environment, I think that really excited her. Mm-hmm. I think she had a wonderful relationship with Dean Stanton. And I think that she would have been more and more embraced at Purdue the longer people got to know her. There was a little bit of friction at Purdue, and I understand why. She did not have a college degree. Mm-hmm. So I think some people were saying, hey, you know, how can this person come in and do this when she doesn't meet the qualifications that we had to have to get this job? But nonetheless, Amelia would have done her thing. And I think she would have absolutely have gone back to Purdue and done some amazing things there. You know where she'd be in the summertime?
Where?
Every summer, she would be in Metisi, Wyoming.
Oh, that's right. Yeah.
And so for the folks who may not recognize that, and this is very sad. I mean, it is quite emotional. It is to me that in, you know, 1934, 35, Amelia and her husband would go out to Metisi and they'd go to the Dude Ranch, and the gentleman who owned it was a good friend of GP's. And, you know, there's that famous photo of Amelia sitting on like a stump, the Dude Ranch owner got her wrapped up in a little napkin, and he's got a knife and a scissor, and he's ready to cut her hair. Yeah. It's a great photo. I mean, she's challenging gender roles right there. She's getting a barber to cut her hair at a dude ranch in Wyoming.
That's awesome.
But what people don't know is that she fell in love with Matisse, and she had asked that gentleman at the dude ranch to build her a log cabin.
That's right.
About a mile up into the mountains, into the woods, because that's where she wanted to be during the summers. And so as someone who has been in higher ed, who loves the summer, it gives you a chance to rejuvenate. It gives you a chance to write. And Amelia loved to write. She loved poetry. She loved to write articles. She wrote books. She was an author. So in my mind, Amelia made that round the world flight, and she went back to teach at Purdue. She cut back on a lot of the lecturing, but she really ingratiated herself at Purdue. In the summertime, she was at her log home in Matisse with GP.
Not a bad way to end a career. Margie, this has been a really special conversation, and I am very, very excited to push this out for people to hear it. And I will say, it's like a masterclass in the legacy, and I really appreciate you coming on the show, and it's a hell of a debut. Thank you for doing this.
Chris, thank you so much. Thank you for having me. Really appreciate it. Thanks for your time. Keep up the good work.
This is Chris Williamson, and thank you for listening to this episode of Chasing Earhart. We hope you've enjoyed the show. Please visit us on social media, where we post each new episode as it airs, news, show information, and group discussion. Go to facebook.com/ChasingEarhart, and on Twitter and Instagram, search the handle @ChasingEarhart. Reviews are crucial to the show. If you enjoyed this episode, please head to Apple Podcasts to rate us and leave us a review. It really does help get the word out. Your editor and host for Chasing Earhart is me, Chris Williamson. The show is produced by my wife, Vanessa Williamson, with music by Dane Jarrus Schmidt. The opinions on Chasing Earhart are those of the individual guests and may not reflect those of Madhouse Films Incorporated. Madhouse Films Incorporated is not affiliated with the films or clips referred to herein. All clips and audio used in the podcast are the intellectual property of their respective copyright holders. They are included here for the purposes of historical entertainment and education, and no infringement is ever intended. Chasing Earhart is an exclusive trademark of Madhouse Films Incorporated and may not be used without the express written consent of Madhouse Films Incorporated. All rights reserved. Chasing Earhart is a Madhouse Films production. All rights reserved.